Well, so today we are going to talk about collective intelligence. Oh, the other big thing is you noticed here it says now Université Paris-Saclay. Whoa. Yes, finally. Paris Sud is dead. It's gone. So I managed to change university, to change affiliation without moving. I've moved from Paris Sud to Paris Saclay, staying in the same office. So what are we going to talk about today? Various topics, from online communities to social media, then recommender systems, and crowdsourcing. So the common points between those different topics is that they are about what I call collective intelligence, the idea, which is an old idea, which you can trace back to Doug Engelbart and even before then, to use technology to harness the power, what is sometimes called the power or the wisdom, wisdoms these days, I don't know, but the power of the crowds, or the idea that the whole is more than the sum of the parts, that if we put together our individual skills and intelligence, we can create things that are better than if we each try to do it independently. And more than that, is the idea that other forms of intelligence emerge from the collaboration and also competition among many individuals. So in terms of the technological aspect of this, as I said, we can trace this back to Engelbart and others before him. But the notion appeared in sociology and more precisely sociobiology with Emil Durkheim. And this notion of collective intelligence is also used in many other fields of social sciences like politics, economics, and of course now CSCW and computer science. So what are the links between this notion of collective intelligence? If you put people together, they are more powerful than individually. In CSCW, there is this vision by Doug Engelbart that he called augmenting human intellect, that combining the power of computers and humans, not just putting humans together, but giving them collective access to the power of computers will augment their intellectual capabilities. Now, I think this is an interesting thing to have in mind in the current world where a lot of things are now done by AI. And what I see more and more is the news media, but also the scientific media saying, oh, now the computer is better than humans at doing this or that. I'm sure you've seen all of these ads, or results. And I think this raises an interesting philosophical question. Is the goal of computer technology, you can call it AI if you want, but these days AI mean computer science, really. So is the goal of AI and computer science to do as well or maybe better than humans at tasks that we are already pretty good at? Or rather, shouldn't we use computers to make things possible that were impossible before? So to enhance our skills in ways that computers alone cannot do, and in ways that humans alone cannot do. Yes?
Isn't the scope automation?
Well, so exactly. A lot of AI today is sold on the premise of automation is good. Driving a car is boring. We're going to drive the car for you. I like driving a car. You know, you think there's any person owning a Ferrari who wants a self-driving Ferrari?
Danger, like humans make mistakes.
So So the argument for the autonomous car is, yes, it's going to save lives. Well, it's probably the case, but it hasn't been proven yet because we have never had enough autonomous cars to really see what happens and what will be the cost associated with this. There are simulations that show that once you have a certain proportion of autonomous cars, things really don't work as well as you would expect. There's more traffic jam, for example, rather than less, because humans are able to do crazy things when there's traffic jams to, you know, fluidify things. They also figure out that, you know, autonomous cars would realize that it's more expensive to find a parking slot and park the car rather than keep going around in the city while you wait for your next order. And therefore, it would, in fact, increase the carbon footprint rather than reduce it, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, there are advantages. And, for example, in the medical field, you know, having systems that are better, at least in some cases, than humans at detecting, some disease can be helpful. But then there's a question is, does this mean we are going to automate this and let computers... Merci, Muriel. And let computers make these decisions for us? Or do we want to make doctors even better than computers by the having the help from computers? Yes, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I think that the philosophy then is more substituting rather than augmenting.
The philosophy, sorry?
Substituting human intelligence instead of augmenting.
Yes, yes. And a lot of the push you see for AI these days is more on substitution or automation rather than augmentation. And I think there are a number of tasks where substitution is fine. There are boring things that, or things that I find boring, that I'm fine having computer do for me. But looking only at this, I think is very limiting. And it also has a more, social implications. A lot of people are afraid of AI because it's going to kill their jobs, right? And what we've seen is, in fact, this has already happened, or rather, it has displaced jobs. And a lot of the argument was, oh, you know, AI is going to displace the boring jobs to make them into more interesting jobs. Do you think this has happened yet? So you think the guy who is on his bike on Deliveroo running around the city rushing to meet his deadline has a better job than the person who were, cooking food in restaurants. All this gig economy that has been created by the AI algorithms that fuel recommender systems and other things that we'll talk about, they have, in fact, displaced jobs. Or they sometimes have created jobs, but they have created shitty jobs, if you excuse the expression. And they have displaced jobs to make people more slave to the machines, to the algorithms, and to the computer, rather than more free. So I think, you know, it's important, especially you guys who are, you know, creating tomorrow's technology, to think a little bit beyond the next app that, you know, may make you rich, to see what is the more global impact on society and what kind of society we want to have. Okay. End of political rant. Well, for the time being, I'm sure I'll indulge again. Anyway, so the point was Doug Engelbart had this vision and created this system, Augment, that I talked about many times, that was designed to combine the power of computers and the power of humans. Paul Fitts, you remember Paul Fitts from Fitts' Law? Well, he didn't just do pointing stuff. he had created this list called what machines are good at and what people are good at, the MAGA-PAGA list. What people are good at, P-A-G-A, PAGA, machines are good at, MAGA, the PAGA-MAGA list, listing, you know, what are people good at, what are machines good at? And instead of trying to have ones replace the other, how can the combination of the two can be more than each individually? So another thing is that until the advent of computer networks, the ability for groups of people to work together was limited by physical constraints. How many people can you put around the table? With computers and networks, we can now have much larger collectives to work together, which raises issues of scalability but at the same time creates maybe more opportunities. So, in fact, the history of computing, which is often told as a history of, you know, creating and better algorithms for this or for that, has also been the history of human-to-human communication mediated by computers. From very early on, when there were just a few computers around the world, they were very specialized, and the operators from these computers were talking to each other so they could hand off a job to another computer that was better suited for the particular task. And email was invented on this type of system, where operators were sending files to process to another computer center and attaching a message to it to say, well, please do this to that file and send it back to me. And then they started using that to communicate with each other just for day-to-day communication, like we send email today. So in the beginning, email was, in fact, attachments of text to files. And 50 years later, we've turned it into changing text and attaching files to those messages, which I think is interesting evolution. But very early on, things like equivalent of chat rooms and discussion groups, bulletin boards, etc., were created to give larger groups of people ways to talk to each other. This has been developed today into things like social networks and social media, or MOOCs, to take another example. But here we are still within the area of how to make people communicate with other people. And the computer is mediating this communication, it's enabling it, but it's not really doing anything with the things that are being communicated. Maybe it's storing them, maybe it's organizing them, but it's not doing much. When we get to recommender systems and crowdsourcing, suddenly we are really combining the notion of communication with the notion of computation. A recommender system is a system that takes information from you, the things you watch on Netflix or the things you look at on Amazon, and based on that makes some computation to recommend another user to watch this movie or to buy this product. And so that's the kind of thing where a computer alone would not be able to do it because it needs the input data, and humans alone are, you know, are not able to manage that kind of amount of data. And so with recommender systems and crowdsourcing, we enter these hybrid systems that I think are really a good example of what augmenting human intellect can be. Although, like any technology, it can also be used in less positive ways, as we will probably discuss. So, again, as I've done in previous classes, let's look a little bit historically. So, if we look at online communities, systems that have been created to help people get in touch and communicate with each other electronically, the first bulletin board system, it's called CBBS, was created in 1978. And more generally, these bulletin boards became very popular in the 80s first, before the web, when the internet started to become more widely available. Until the 90s, the internet was mostly available to universities, to research centers, to academia in general, much less so to industry. Industry was using networks for some services, but not really for this kind of things. And then in the 90s, with the advent of the web, that unified or gave a sort of unified framework in terms of protocols, in terms of formats, this kind of things took over. I'll talk about the web in a little bit, but interestingly, in the 1980s, the French telecom created the Minitel. I think I've talked about the Minitel already a bit. So this was something that was deployed across all of France for free. If you agreed to give away the phone book, each year the phone company would give you a new phone book with the white pages and the yellow pages. You guys remember that? Yeah. You've seen those at your parents, yes? So the white page. So what's the difference between the white and yellow pages?
White for privates and yellow for companies.
Right. So yellow pages list businesses, and white pages list individual phone numbers. And every year the thing would get thicker and thicker, and you can imagine it costs a lot to produce, to distribute. Not speaking of the environmental cost. So they created this Minitel system, and their selling point was, even though you didn't have to pay for it, was you don't have to pay for it, you can get it for free if you don't take these big phone books, and the phone books will be in the computer. But they were also clever in creating an infrastructure so that individuals or companies could create additional services that people would be able to access on the Minitel. When I say the Minitel was free, it was not exactly free. The device was free, but when you connected, it used your phone line, and some services like the yellow and white pages were actually free, but other services you had to pay. And you had to pay by the minute, like a long distance call. Which, you know, in today's world was like, you know, if you paid by the minute the time you spend online, I think we'd have different usage patterns. And so a lot of services were created for the Minitel. Originally, the French telecom thought, well, you know, people will create services to have the schedules of the trains, of the planes, to have access to, I don't know, banking information or this kind of services, sort of the one-to-many type of services. And a number of those were indeed created. And I remember in the mid-80s checking on the Minitel, you know, when I had to go pick up someone at the airport if the plane was going to be on time, which is something you couldn't do before because if you try to call the airport, nobody would pick up. So there were some very useful services. But very quickly, people created the equivalent of bulletin board and chat rooms and systems for people to communicate with each other. And that made a number of people very rich. Do you know Free, the company Free? Yeah. Yes? Which is not free, huh? You noticed? Well, the guy who created Free made a fortune on the Minitel. And I won't go into details because he got into trouble for some things he did. But anyway, but I did it fortune by creating messaging services, let's say. So what's interesting is that the messaging services on the Minitel were the primary use, was the type of system that was more used than anything else, right? And the thing is that every time, and time and again, we've seen it with the telephone, we've seen it with you know, other electronic media these days, every time you give people a way to communicate, they will sort of take it and appropriate it. In fact, in the Minitel, they did, and I think I've told the story already, but they did this experiment in the city of Vélizy, not very far from here, and they gave it to a few hundred families, and observed how they were using it, and they were able to observe what people were doing and to send people messages on the bottom line of the screen. And then some hackers discovered that, in fact, they could use this messaging system to talk to each other, which, of course, the engineers from the Minitel didn't like because it was not supposed to be used that way. But it's just to show that things are used for communication in ways that you usually don't expect. And again, the system was designed originally to be one-to-many and became a sort of group communication system rather than a mass media of sorts. So there are many types of systems that exist to foster online communities, from real-time chat to chat rooms, which are real-time but also store the content of the discussion. I'm sure many of you know IRC. Yes? No? Internet Relay Chat? Okay. Still alive? Probably. Okay. You don't know. You don't know IRC. Well, IRC was a sort of a network of servers where you could create permanent chat rooms, and you connect to a chat room, and you could discuss, and there were topics and stuff. So it was very popular before the web. What?
Slack.
Hmm?
Before Slack.
Before Slack, yes. Let's put it this way. So then you have things that are meant to be more asynchronous, like forums and message boards, where you post a message, and then people read it when they read it. And very early on, also things like online games, sort of collaborative games, and shared repositories were created. And so early on, starting in the 80s, mid-80s, people, some researchers, started to study the behavior of users of these systems, since it enabled new forms of communication. And so what they found is that when you become a member of one of these communities, typically you start as what they call a lurker, so you are peripheral. You look what's going on, but you don't do much. You're sort of watching, trying to understand the rules, the expression, the net etiquette. Netiquette? You are familiar with this term?
Yes.
Yes? The sort of spoken or unspoken rules on how you should behave. Avoid trolling or insulting people, etc. And so as a lurker in the beginning, you sort of discover, you know, what are the norms of this particular group, what is okay to talk about or not, and or how you should behave in general. Then you have you don't like it and you leave, but if you stay, you become a novice where you start participating in the conversations and all that, but you're not a recognized member of the community, I would say, to a regular and then to a leader, where essentially you gain social status within the community. Now, in the early systems, there was no difference in terms of what these different types of users or different roles could play, but you know that in more modern systems, sometimes you have different capabilities associated with different roles. And so in some systems, if you've been there long enough and you've been a good citizen, then you are able to do things that others cannot do, like moderating other people's posts or things like this. And then when you get old or tired, you become what this study called an elder, or outbound someone who's sort of stepping away, either because they are not interested anymore or maybe because they are indeed old. And this thing is something that you see time and again in all social networks and online discussion groups. So, as I said, the advent of the World Wide Web really had a huge impact on these online communities, because before the World Wide Web, there were all these different systems that also were running typically on command line interfaces, so not a very user-friendly interface. You needed to be, you know, interested in the technology to be able to run these things. So with the World Wide Web, it made two things essentially. It made the a unified set of protocols and formats. So you could, you know, run everything inside the same browser. You didn't have to change your interface in your system with everything. And with an interface that was more user-friendly than having to type cryptic commands on the command line interface. Now, the reason the World Wide Web came to be was, in fact, to support a community. And that was to support the community of researchers in high-energy physics. In high-energy physics, researchers have to collaborate on a large scale because not only for the exchange of ideas, which is something that, you know, every group of researcher typically needs, but also because they create these very large collaborations to create these big, massively expensive instruments like the Large Hadron Collider at CERN or other accelerators around the world. And these are projects that require work from thousands of people over, you know, 10 or 20 years. And until the World Wide Web, they didn't have good ways to share their information and data with each other, to store this information in a way that was accessible to everyone, etc. And so Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web really for this community, saying, well, you know, I'm going to create a hypertext system based on these two standards, HTML, how to represent documents, HTTP, how to communicate between clients and server, to help these people. And what was key to him was that everybody had to be able to be both a consumer of information made available on this network, but also an author. And in fact, when he created the first web browser, he created a web browser that supported both reading web pages, but also authoring them. You didn't have to go in a different tool and write HTML. You could do this in the browser itself if you had access right to save the document on the server where it was living. Unfortunately for him, he had decided to do this on the next computer from the company that Steve Jobs created after leaving Apple. And the next was never the success that Steve Jobs was expecting it to be. And so there was this web browser and this web infrastructure that was only accessible for people who had Next machines. And even though most of them were indeed in academia, it was still a very small proportion. And so then Mark Anderson implemented a browser on the Unix platform called Mosaic, which became Netscape, etc. But he didn't have time to implement the authoring part. And I think the system that we had originally, which was really designed to be a sort of large-scale built-in board system or shared repository and support for person-to-person and group communication became mostly a system to consume content that was authored by people who had both the knowledge and the access rights. And I find it quite, well, sad that these days, through the development of the standards for the web, adding, in particular, the ability to have JavaScript code in a page, that when you want to build content that can be edited by the users, by the readers, you have to ship with the page all the code to let users edit the content of the page. And when you load the slide, this small piece of web content these days, it comes with megabytes of JavaScript to create and recreate always the same features of having pull-down menus and commenting boxes and etc., which are usually, in my opinion, poorly done and should be features of the browser not stuff that you ship with every single page. So anyway, that's an aside. The result is that very quickly, and I remember the period of time from 92, 93 to 95, 96, so in a period of 4 years tops, the web went from something that nobody had ever heard of to something that everybody in academia was using, which then created its own problems because a lot of content became available on the web, and very quickly, as early as 91, in fact, the first search engines were created. And at first, the web was small enough that instead of search engines, people were creating, what was it called? Lists of sites organized by themes. And Yahoo started as a handmade list of recommended sites on the web if you're looking for this type of information or that type of information. And it took a couple more years for automated search engines to get started, and then a few more for Google to arrive. The first search engines like AltaVista were very heavily used, and then Google wiped them all. And as I say, it started as a system to support collective intelligence and collaboration, and it took over 15 years to get these interactive capabilities of authoring the content of a page, chatting, blogging, commenting. In the original Mosaic, you could add comments like post-it notes on a page. Those comments would be saved locally on your machine, attached to the address of that page. So they were not shared with everybody else reading the page, but it could be your own personal annotations on that page. And next time you reload the page, those annotations are pulled from your local disk and displayed again. And that was super useful. And that's, again, a facility that has disappeared today. It could be a feature of the browser itself, but it's not. So it took 15 years to then go from the original browser to the state we have today, where a lot more support is given to interaction and to communication. But even though the web was very limited in the beginning, some people created facilities to support community of researchers or community of users where everybody could be both an author and a consumer of information. And the first one, it's always dangerous to say the first one, but the one who's known as being the first one to do this in a way that has had a wide impact is Ward Cunningham, who in 94, so again at the very beginning of the web becoming widely available, created what he called the WikiWikiWikiWeb. And the WikiWikiWeb is a web server. I say here still exists. I don't know, you should check. It was still existing last year. I didn't check this year. So what it was a web server, a regular web server, but you could edit any page. So this is the original welcome page from the WikiWikiWeb. And you wrote content not in HTML, but in a simplified markup language, something similar but even simpler than Markdown. You guys know Markdown?
Yes.
Yeah? So Markdown is sort of HTML without all the fluff. So a simpler syntax to say, well, if I want something bold, I put an asterisk around it, and et cetera. Here, you did not even have to specify the links like you do in Markdown. If you wrote a string of characters that started with an uppercase letter and had at least another uppercase letter in the string, it was automatically seen as a link to a page in the same server. So you could write text, say, you know, the wiki way here, and then it would create a link. If the page didn't exist, the first time you click on it, it gives you a form so you can create that page, and then that becomes the proper link. So something really lightweight, you didn't need to know anything about what was going on in the background. So this wiki server was used by a community of researchers on software patterns, and it was known as the Portland Pattern Repository. Now, do you know why it's called wiki? Say again? Exactly. That's why there's this picture of this shuttle bus called the WikiWiki, which is in Honolulu, the shuttle that goes from the airport to the city, I believe. And wiki in Hawaiian means fast. And so the idea was to make it fast to see a page, modify it, and everybody has access to the modification, or create a new page and link it to other pages. Now, of course, there is something that you all know that starts with wiki, which is Wikipedia. Well, Wikipedia is a direct offshoot of the wiki web. And in fact, in Wikipedia, when you click a link to edit a page, it's the same type of interface that you had in the original wiki. So Wikipedia is a good example of what a large online community can build. I think it's a good example of the whole being more than the sum of the parts. As you know, it's an online encyclopedia. It's the largest one. These numbers are probably old now, and the number of users is certainly... certainly very wrong these days. I don't know how long ago I did this slide, but I should update it. So largest encyclopedia, certainly in English, but also has versions in many, many languages. Of course, different sizes in different languages. And everybody can be an author. Everybody can be an author. And studies have shown that even though it's not perfect, and they are, errors and etc., Wikipedia is more accurate, generally speaking, than Encyclopedia Britannica, which is sort of considered the best of encyclopedia. And the fact that you have this community of people that collaborate is the key to make this thing actually work. Now, of course, when this kind of system sort of takes on and everybody comes in, you have problems in any, you know, collective, in any human society. Not everybody is going to play the game. And so very early on, they instituted a system where, yes, everybody could be an author. And in fact, everybody could be an anonymous author. But there's also people who have additional rights and capabilities to monitor pages, to lock pages if sometimes there are edit wars going on a particular page where people have different opinions about something and once make a change and then someone from the other camp comes back and does the change or does another change, etc. And so some pages that have very high activity suddenly, the system is watching them and alerting a Wikipedia editor who then can decide what to do, either to let it go for a while, see if it comes down, or lock the page temporarily, or put a message saying, well, you know, information here is, people have not made up their minds yet. But I think what's remarkable is that given the scale of this thing, that it works, in fact, so well, especially, I mean, if you use Wikipedia, right? Yes, they do this on a shoestring. I mean, they use very little money to run this thing. Every year, they do this campaign to to get money, but even though, well, benefits from some support from various companies and stuff, but it's really remarkable how well it works. And then they created a whole galaxy of other wiki things, such as Wikibooks. So how many of you know Wikibooks? Yes? So Wikibooks, the idea is to create things that are similar or are actually textbooks, but in a collective way. And so anybody can start a Wikibook. You can, you know, start an outline and say, and start writing a chapter, and then anybody can add content and etc. A few years ago, we did in our group a study of how do Wikibooks get written, because writing a book collectively like this is kind of an unusual experience, and try to understand also how, well, can we correlate the edit pattern of the book with its success? What does make a Wikibook be a good book, meaning a book used by many people? And it was interesting to watch, so we had access to all the log of edits of the books, and we could see a number of patterns, including the fact that for a book to be successful, at some point you need to have multiple authors contribute content. But for the book to be successful, after that you need a phase where a few people, one person or a small group, will take all that and sort of make it consistent and turn it into a real book rather than sort of a collection of things. But there's other wiki sites. So Wikidata is a site that tries to gather data from various sources that's available for free. I don't know, well, WikiQuotes is about citations. WikiNews, I don't think WikiNews is that active these days, but also tries to gather free content, news, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these, in fact, is sort of the new, I don't want to say the new, but typically how these bulletin boards and system where people were posting information has sort of all coalesced into this type of wiki-like systems. Now, another big trend has been web blogging or blogs. So the notion of blogs, so blogs started also very early on in the lifespan of the web, in the mid-90s. The term blog was coined by John Barger, who was creating one of these blog. And so it was called web logging. So the idea is that you go on the web and, you know, you take pictures of your life and you comment what you've seen. So it's an online log of your activity. It's an online journal. And so it was a web log, which got abbreviated as blog. Now, unlike wikis, here the goal is not to have content that is created collectively, but instead is typically edited by a single person. It's typically time-based. You have posts which are time-stamped. Sometimes it's open for comments, which provides, of course, possibilities of exchanges among users. But it's not really community-oriented. I mean, a blog is, you know, you do a blog if you think you have things to say that other people might be interested in. But it's not to build a community. It's more to build, I would say, an identity to make yourself known. So we know that blogs have had an important role as a new medium of expression, because unlike books or writing news in a newspaper, there's no intermediate. You don't have to get someone to approve your writing for it to be available to millions of people. You open a blog. With the blog platforms these days, it takes two clicks, and there you are. And then people read you or don't read you. They like you or they dislike you. So some blogs have been very influential politically and have had political impact, and there's the examples of the various blogs that have contributed to social movements in various parts of the world. So they have value. I mean, it's not just people telling their lives. It goes beyond that. Like what?
Like maybe fans of somebody, like somebody is holding a blog, all the fans of a community, like they chat each other.
Okay.
Comments.
No? Yeah, so, but is that a blog that is hosted by one person? Or is it, well.
For example, you know, Kiara Ragni, the fashion blogger, she had a community back then.
Okay.
In the 90s, and now she's an entrepreneur, but there was a community in the beginning.
I think. I guess what I wanted to say here is that a blog is not necessarily created as a service to the community the way something like Wikipedia, to take that extreme example, would be. The fact that a blog will attract attention and interest and will have many people following it and etc. and indeed create a community, yes, I agree, it's still possible. And in fact, I think it's where there is this kind of morphing between the blog as they were originally used and the social networking of today.
Can we think of Facebook pages as blogs? Those are communities, and there are also usually one or two people editing content for this community. So.
Okay, now disclaimer. I am not on Facebook. So I'm probably not the right person to talk about this stuff, like social media, because not only I'm not on Facebook, I'm not on Twitter, I'm not on LinkedIn, I'm not on any social network I know. I think for good reasons. but the downside of this is that, yes, there's many features that I don't know about. I follow it and I talk to people, etc. But I'm not a user, and so I don't know exactly the feature of Facebook you're referring to. But the fact that on Facebook there is something that could resemble a blog wouldn't surprise me, right? And so the thing is that all these various types of systems I talked about, you know, they sort of dance around the same notion that people like to share information. People like to have access to other people's opinions or recommendations about things. People like to discuss things, etc. And so all of this used to be done on different types of tool, like, you know, chat rooms and then built-in boards and then etc. And blogs and all that. And suddenly, this notion of social media sort of popped up in the landscape. To me, social media, I don't know what is the real definition of a social media, but for me, it's an umbrella term for all these tools that allow community to create content, to share content, to add comments to content, etc. And so it includes forums and blogs and wikis. Something that was very popular at some point was social bookmarking sites. I don't know if anybody remembers Delicious. So it was delicio.us, the website, and it was recommendations where you just posted the link to a page that, you know, was on a certain topic, and it was sort of self-curated. So these were called bookmarking sites. So all of the systems now have been sort of integrated under this umbrella of social media. And we talk about social media because it's media, so content, that is created and created by the readers of that media. Unlike the mass media, meaning the press, where you have certain people, the journalists, who have the right to write news or to give their opinion about something, and then you, the rest of the people, are allowed to read it. So mass media embody this asymmetry between those who have the right to write and those who read, whereas in social media, everybody is supposedly equal. Now, of course, this creates a number of issues. We tend to rely on the mass media because we tend to trust journalists who are supposedly people who have been trained, who have been qualified and vetted for... I hear people laughing here. historically, yes, I mean, you couldn't say I'm a journalist just, you know, by raising your hand. You had to get credentials and etc. And so the mass media was, and I insist on was, linked to notion of quality of the news, reliability of the news, and also you would count on a certain frequency of the news. So you had newspapers every day, you had things that, you know, is every week, so it's not the same type of content. And we were not so used to immediacy. The fact that, you know, a news, something could happen somewhere in the world, and immediately the entire world knows about it, is very, very recent. And that's because the time it took for the information to come from where the things happened to a news outlet who would then take the time to send a journalist on site to see what's going on, that journalist to take pictures, maybe, or his photographer, then go back to the hotel, type his thing on some probably typewriter or maybe computer, then transmit that to the newspaper or even the TV media, if he was working for TV, and that to be broadcast or printed, that would take, at the very least, hours and more often days. Nowadays, everybody can pretend they're a journalist, be somewhere, shoot something with their smartphone, mail it to somewhere, and a minute later, it's online for everyone. Now, this, of course, like everything, has pros and cons. I think many things enabled by technology have to do with speed. Things being faster to do, getting faster to a place, knowing about things faster. In fact, there are philosophers like Paul Virilio have written about this notion of speed, how modern society is driven by everything being faster and faster, and commenting that, you know, our brains are not necessarily getting faster and faster, so at some point it becomes difficult to absorb all this amount of information and the rate of that information. So it has good sides in this immediacy, and it has bad side because it means there's much less reflection. The other aspect of this is that so many versions of the news happen from everywhere that things that were seen as references for good or reliable news now are being challenged. And people prefer to go to a particular news outlet or a particular blog or a particular source of information because they feel they trust it more. Which leads us to something called the internet bubble, which I'll get to in a second. So I think in general, this social media are a modern version of online communities. I would say that the focus is more on the individual than the community. I don't know, on something like Facebook, you cannot create collective content, right? Everything you do, it's one person who does it on their, under their account. More or less, or...
A page is an account that can be shared between people.
Yes, but the page belongs to someone. On Wikipedia, the page belongs to nobody. And so I think it creates kind of asymmetry somewhere. And well, we all know the roots of Facebook, which I don't think was really, despite what Mark Zuckerberg keeps saying, but the fact that he says this so much, I think, is telling that it's not to build a community, in my opinion. Well, which gets me to the next point about social media. But what I wanted to say here. So yeah, so it creates this. It creates this intertwined communities where you decide to be part of this, part of that, to follow this person or to be a friend to that person, to have that person as a friend, which in a sense replicates what happens in the physical world where we do have friends, but because of the features of online media can be done at a scale that wouldn't work at the human scale. The studies by sociologists show that people have a social network, but their physical social networks of real individuals never scales beyond 100 people. And not many people have really 100 people they can call their close friends, right? Now, the game on social media is to have as many friends as you can, right? Or the system encourages you, recommends that, this friend of yours is friend with that person, so you should be friend with hers, et cetera, et cetera. Is that done really for the benefit of the community or for the benefit of the company running the system? I think you know the answer. So, here I'm trying to make a distinction between social media, which is a sort of a set of collective behaviors that are enabled by technology, with social networking sites, which is the infrastructure and the means by which you can support these communities. And social networking sites themselves should be distinguished from social networks, because in computer science and social science, the social network is the graph of the relationship between people. That's the social network. Now, of course, we use these terms interchangeably, so sometimes it can be a little bit confusing. So in social networking sites, I think what distinguishes them, and that includes, of course, Facebook, Twitter, and so on, and Instagram, and so on, I still think the emphasis is put on the individual, because you have to register, you have to create your profile, you have to then decide to invite people or attract followers, which are people. So it's really the individual is at the center. And yes, it can be used to create or support communities, but those communities are not, I would say, reified, existed as such in the system. Now, of course, a lot of the dynamics of these social networking sites is the idea that people trust the people they know more than the people they don't know, right? So what's underlying all these features is the idea that if you're a friend with someone, you trust what the someone likes, the movies they watch, the things they buy, and you are, in that sense, closer to them than to people with whom you are not friends. And this is this assumption that fuels, one, the push for the systems to have more friends and therefore more relationships, and second, so they can, in a sense, gather more information about the stuff you like and dislike, which itself fuels the recommender systems that are the means by which they make money. Because there's something that is very weird, I believe, when I was talking about the Minitel earlier, I said, well, you know, with the Minitel, you had to pay every time you turned the thing on, you had to pay like a phone call by the minute. And a lot of people had very bad surprises at the end of the first month of playing with the Minitel. But here we are in a system where everything is free, right? But maintaining an infrastructure like that of Facebook cannot be free, so someone has to pay. And so here, a whole economy has been built on the idea that it's not the customer who's paying for the service, it's through advertising. But for advertising to be efficient, they need information about who to advertise to, meaning the users. And so the whole thing is fueled by the need to gather personal data so that they can create targeted advertising, which is more effective and which advertisers are going to pay more money for. And I think that essentially twists the entire thing. But it's done in a very clever way, and a lot of people are not even aware of that or don't see a problem with that. Now, the thing is that if you're, you know, if you're talking about the weather or the next soccer game, etc., it's fine. But when people on social networks, because it's a person-to-person, so it also creates a sense of intimacy, when you start sharing information that is more private, the fact that, I don't know, maybe you have a disease. Well, this information is then available to the company running the system, and they can sell that to the people who are selling medical insurance. So I think, unfortunately, the companies running social networks are playing on the fact that the people at large, probably not you, hopefully not you, are very naive about all this stuff, right? And I don't like exploiting people's naivety myself. It also plays very well because there is this notion of social value. You know, in the modern world, your social authority depends on how many friends and how many important friends you can have. So this is very clever psychological engineering, I would say, to gather personal data. And on top of that, of course, everything you post on the social network belongs to the social network. So you don't control ownership. And each site is its own silo. Now, that's something that I was found surprising. Why is it so important that each site is independent of each other? That you're on Facebook, you have an account, you're on Twitter, it's a different thing. Well, you could argue, you know, Twitter and Facebook are two different types of media. But even among sites, you know, what was the Google one? Google?
Facebook are the same group.
Well, they belong to the same company, which adds to the problem in a sense, because they look like something different, but then they can cross the information from these two sources and get even more about you. If you look at email, you know, if I am on Gmail and you are on, I don't know, I was going to say Yahoo, but that would be insulting, right? So I'm on the university email server and you are on Gmail, we can still exchange email. We don't have to have our mail hosted on the same on the servers from the same companies so we can exchange email, right? And this is because email is defined by a protocol. A protocol so that an email server can talk to an email client. So the email server can talk to your Outlook client or my Apple Mail client or to Thunderbird. If we agree on the protocol of what is a message, how do we describe the headers, who it's who it's going to, etc., etc., then it doesn't matter who are the where are the servers, where are the clients, and who wrote the code for them. Now, in a social network, it's pretty much the same thing. I mean, all the things are a little bit the same, right? Whether you call them friends or followers or etc., you could, and in fact, early on, there were efforts from Google but it was too late. Facebook was too big at the time. They went to Facebook to say, well, why don't we create a standard for social networks so that we can have a system that interoperates? And I don't know if you've seen that, but Twitter recently announced they were going to try to do something like this. And the World Wide Web Consortium has created standards for these kind of things. But it's not taking on because the businesses that have been created around these sites is so twisted that there is no interest from the companies in sharing their data because it's the data from which they're making money. If they were charging... So here's a question for you. How many of you subscribe a monthly subscriptions to something like Spotify or Deezer, Apple Music, etc.? Okay, so willing to pay $5 a month, more or less? Yes? To have music all the time. Would you be able, would you be willing to pay the same monthly fee to be on Facebook in exchange of Facebook not harvesting your data and not inundating you with advertising?
Now maybe yes.
One person, maybe two.
Yeah.
Okay. Now explain to me that.
Because now we know.
I asked my kids who were with us at Christmas, who are pretty much your age. They couldn't explain that to me. So I'm really curious. No, but really.
I would like to do that because I don't want them to be able to sell my data. Without
okay. Yeah, but you are the one willing to pay. I want to hear from those who are not willing to pay.
Well, it seems like really negative that the whole sharing of data. I think it's also, this might be an unpopular opinion, it doesn't seem that insidious right now.
So it doesn't bother you that Google can tell that there are good chances you are pregnant before you even know?
That is,
no, but this is not a theoretical example. It is, there have been studies of this.
Google. I would pay for Google now.
You would pay for Google. Okay, yeah, I got two people on board.
Reddit is Facebook is not as important compared to other social networking, like the friction to go towards Twitter or Telegram or whatever.
Well, I said Facebook, but
yeah,
it was.
But that's
just
why I wouldn't pay. And I'm also not that concerned about the privacy. Whether they can know if I'm not pregnant, but another thing.
Okay.
It doesn't mind.
You don't mind?
Yeah.
Yes?
It's more like if I had to pay, then I would just stop using them. Just like, I mean, if I don't want them to collect my data, then I just don't use them.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, I don't use them. I don't feel like I'm, you know, left out of society, but...
But you're using WhatsApp, I guess.
I don't use WhatsApp. I'm on zero social network.
SMS?
Yes, I use. Yeah, no, I text. Yeah, I use text.
What if instead of a monthly subscription, you pay for adding friends and followers? That's better. I will do that, like, more easily. Like, you just pay for your own friends. So you just have.
So it's interesting because when we worked. I think it was a follow-up of this interliving project I talked about before, where one of the ideas that came up was having a bracelet with beads that would represent your friends. But of course, on a bracelet, you have a limited number of beads you can put on. So at some point, if you want to add one more friend, you have to get rid of one of them. And when we were discussing this with the people, this was a participatory design workshop, and I don't remember exactly the details, But someone said, well, this is really great because it gives me, you know, plausible deniability. Oh, I had to take you off. But, you know, it's because I can't put another one. So paying for, adding friends. That's an interesting idea. You were first?
Yeah, do you consider WhatsApp and, like, messaging application, like, as a social network?
I don't know. You have to tell me what WhatsApp is. I know the name. To me, it's a messaging application. Yeah.
It's a messaging application.
Yeah.
I know, but it's still just a messaging application. It's not really like
So I'll tell you what. I went to India, someone we were invited for a wedding, and the person who invited us said, "Well, here's the WhatsApp connection for the person who will pick you up at the airport." And then I was like, oh shit, I have to be on WhatsApp? So I downloaded the app, I went into it, I started creating my account, and then suddenly it asks me my phone number. Okay, I'm kind of, And then the next thing it says is that it's going to have access to all of my, it asks for access to all of my contacts. And if I say no, I cannot use WhatsApp. And I'm like, no way, I'm sorry. So we found another way to get in touch with a taxi driver. So that's where I think there is, and I think the GDPR, the French regulation on trying to get informed consent from users about the use of their personal data is going in the right direction. The thing is, I want people to make informed choices and to have a choice. And the choice should not be either you give me all your data and you have access to the platform, or nothing. You know, there are ways to do things in between. And so that's what bothers me with WhatsApp. I think they're, you know, they're doing something I don't like, and I don't know why.
I have observed one thing on Facebook. Facebook is tracking whom I'm calling and how many
times. Oh, yes, absolutely.
I've seen that. It displays all the list, how many times I called.
Now, you know, you can ask Facebook, you can ask Google, because now it's mandated by law in Europe, thanks to the GDPR, to give you the data they have on you. Well, try it. Yes?
Play a bit devil's advocate.
Something yes, of course.
Something that I see that people comment online is that actually the targeting advertisement is an added value. Because people would receive advertisement anyway and would care more about something relevant for them than pregnancy tests, you know?
Sure, and I understand that. But why not have a choice of paying and not having advertising, or not paying and having advertising, and more transparency about what information is collected? That's in a sense, that's all I'm asking. It's give users a choice. But the economy of advertising is the systems in general, I think is really spooky, because the amount of data is being collected. Because, you know, in the same way as this notion of collective intelligence, a collection of humans can be more powerful than the sum of these individual intelligences, all the data that is being collected, when you put it together, it tells you so much more than each bits of data added to each other, because you can make correlation. There was a thing recently, I believe, where it was an application for jogging. People, you know, go running and they have a thing on their smartphones tracking their etc. It was, I think, some soldiers in the military who were using this app, not thinking twice about what it was tracking, but the information was there for this company and somehow got leaked, which allowed, you know, an enemy to figure out where these people were. And so that's all these ramifications that we don't understand. I'll talk later on about the Netflix prize, where Netflix gave a database of people's what people had watched on Netflix, and it was anonymized. Or the comments that the people on Netflix had put in the Netflix database, which Netflix uses for doing recommendations. But they ran an annual contest. I'll talk about it. And so they made part of this database available, and they anonymized it. So they removed the names, and they also added noise to it.
Very nice.
It's very nice.
It's really expensive for a company to anonymize data.
Yes. Now, what happened? Two researchers, I don't remember from which university, took this database, anonymized database, went on IMDb, you know IMDb? Mm-hmm. Internet Movie Database, were able to correlate comments done by the same, by people at relevant times on the same movies, and they were able to de-anonymize, I don't remember if it was 60 or 80% of the names in the Netflix database.
So who was copy-pasting on both sides?
Well, it said you comment on Netflix and then you comment on IMDb and you don't think twice about it. And that's enough to triangulate and identify you from the one that is supposedly anonymous. Well, but that's... And that's the power of computers. They're good at this stuff. So I think it's important to raise awareness about these things. I don't want to paint, you know, all these companies as evil, etc. I mean, they're there to do business. But if there's no pressure from the users, there's no reason that it's going to change. And I think there are alternatives. And I think having more open protocols, you know, Twitter for many years had an API that was open so that anybody could write a Twitter client. And there were much better Twitter clients than the official one. And then one day they decided to shut down the API, and now they control the apps that you use to look at Twitter. I think that's sad. And, you know, in a world where we're supposed to encourage competition and et cetera, in fact, they create massive monopolies that have way more power than any kind of industry before, because they refuse any regulation because it would stifle innovation, which I think is
for privacy reasons. It's like the Facebook APIs. They got closed after all the problems with privacy because developers could backtrack anyone.
Yeah, but it's because they didn't, you know.
Way.
Yeah, well, but you have to do the right API. I mean, you know, you have to. plus, you know, you can also. I mean, the thing is, technology is never neutral, and technology alone cannot solve problems. So I think you need to combine, technological fences, in a sense, with also. Rules and laws, so that you can go after, you know, people who misuse an API based on the fact that they didn't follow the rules that were put forward, and not just block things technologically. It's not a simple issue. I will give you that. Okay, I think. Let me just quickly go on these last two slides, and then we'll take a break, and then you'll get to do some work. I have two slides here. One is on social navigation. So, and I don't remember what it is I wanted to say about this. Social navigation, so Dorish and Chalmers in 1994 were also starting to look at how people navigate among this large web of websites that were cropping up at the time, and trying to see if there were similarities or differences between spatial navigation, navigate a city, and navigation in the sea or in a web of information. And the idea was that which in a sense you could say led a little bit to the PageRank algorithm for Google, was the idea that if many people follow the same link, this link has more value than the link that is followed by very few people. Right? And so the idea is that instead of being passive media, the web, to take that example, could give you information about how many, you know, people have navigated that link versus this one. So you, it's like when you are in the outdoors and you see a path that has been created by the fact that most people have walked that particular path as opposed to another one, and you see, well, this is the most traveled path, so I'm going to take it, or I'm going to decide to not take it because precisely everybody's taking it. So the idea was to have this type of information in the content. It could be also other things, that how many people have traversed the link. It could be how many people have left comments, and etc. And then you could take into account the social authority of the people who have left comments or the people who have navigated the link to have a better notion of what is, quote, important. As I said, this was done in 94, and it was really pretty much the same type of approach that was taken by Google Larry Page and Sergey Brin when they were still students at Stanford, and they created the Google's PageRank algorithm. The PageRank algorithm in Google essentially is weighing the pages according to how many links point to this page as opposed to how many links go out of this page. And so the idea behind this is a sort of operationalization of the wisdom of the crowd by making, by keeping track of what people are doing, we can make better recommendations for other people when they do the same type of navigation. And that will lead also to recommender systems, which I will talk about next time. And to wrap this up, there is a whole area of research that has existed for a long time, but has been revived by this advent, not only of social networking site and social media, but also the structure of links in the web, to analyze these social networks, these graphs that represent information about put in by people. And so there's a lot of work done on the mathematical analysis of these networks. And one thing that comes again and again is that these networks are usually what is called small world networks. If you imagine a graph where the nodes are pages and the links are hyperlinks between those pages, or a graph where the nodes are people or people's account on a social networking site, and the links are who is friend with whom or his, who is following whom, in both cases you get a graph, right? What can we say about this graph? Well, the kind of things you like to measure about a graph is, if I take two nodes randomly, what is the average length of the shortest path from one to the other? And it turns out that what is called small world networks are networks where you have an average distance that is very short without the graph being fully connected. So with very few connections, you can still have very good connectivity. I don't know if you know the theory of 6 degrees of separation. Yes? So the idea is that you take two people in the world and you can find a string of at most 6 people linking the two where they know each other. So you are 6 degrees away from Donald Trump. Sad, isn't it?
At most six.
At most six. Anyway, so it turns out that a lot of the graphs that we see in these social networking sites have these features of small world networks. And the thing is that it's also been shown that this provide, and the way a small world network works is that essentially things are a little bit like hierarchical. So a bunch of nodes are connected to one node, which itself is with a few other of similar nodes connected to a bigger one, etc. So you have this kind of hierarchical structure, which is also very efficient to distribute information. And that's why through social networks, news, and particularly fake news, can propagate very quickly. Because it goes from one node sort of at the bottom of this hierarchy, and then can go quickly to the more important nodes higher up, and then from there can spread around in just a few hops. Okay, so I suggest that we stop here and we take a break. When you come back, maybe you can organize yourself in the groups for the project, so you can work on that, and I'll go around and see with each of you where you are. Okay? Any questions? Burning questions? No? Good.